Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Daily Friend Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer. Today, I'm joined by Mr. Chris Hutton. Chris, how are you doing?
Hey, Nick and Charlene, you're doing okay, thanks. A sad day for the RR and for the liberal movement in South Africa, but we're here to honor John's memory and to continue the work.
Indeed, and we will get to that a little bit shortly after we finish our ad read. And Sholem, also good to have you here with us today. How are you doing?
Yeah, Nick, I'm doing good, and as always, excited to be on the show, man.
Cool. So just first a word from our sponsor, Bitvice. They say that Bitcoin is the complete hedge against the global debasement of money, inflation, and government overreach. Bitvice is a South African first Bitcoin-only self-custody solution that helps individuals and entities buy and hold Bitcoin for the long term. Bitvice believes that everyone should hold their own Bitcoin and trust no one else. Recently, there have been a plethora of crypto custodians going bankrupt, taking their clients' Bitcoin with them. That is why Bitvice never holds your Bitcoin. They send it immediately to your own Bitcoin wallet where you hold the keys. They don't hold your keys. They don't hold your coins. Simply sign up to Bitvice, link your bank account securely, and buy Bitcoin in seconds. Visit bitvice.io and begin your journey in buying and securing the scarcest asset that mankind has ever created. And once again, we thank them very much for sponsoring us. So for us at the IRR, the Daily Friend, the CRA, the Freedom Advocacy Network, the sort of whole this liberal network in South Africa, we lost one of our greats last night, unfortunately, and that is, of course, Mr. John Kane Berman, who was a former CEO of the Institute of Race Relations from 1983 until 2014. I'm going to just quickly go through a little bit of his life, but I won't be able to do it justice at all, which is why tomorrow there will be a special podcast with current CEO John Endres and former CEO Frans Cronier on his life and achievements. So yeah, look out for that. But John Kane Berman, some of you may know him from his writings in Politics Web and The Daily Friend, but he had a very, very long, illustrious career. He studied at St. John's College in Houghton, and then he went to Wits, and then finally to Oxford as a Rhodes Scholar. He came from a pretty political family. His father, Louis, was a household name in South Africa. So he was a chairman of the Torch Commando, which were Second World War veterans who rallied to the cause when nationalists sought to take colored voters off the voters' roll. At Wits, John Kane Berman led campaigns against social segregation and government interference in higher education, earning him the wrath of many apartheid government ministers. He himself was accused of being, quote, a totalitarian liberal while he was a member of NUSAS, and was accused of also being a front for foreign ideologies, the risk of being manipulated by pro-communist elements. At one point, he also even had a run-in, I believe, with John Foster, who was not pleased to see him at all. He then later got a job after going to Oxford and coming back at the Financial Mail, where he used it as an opportunity to write about many issues. Many of them were very embarrassing to the apartheid government. He wrote a book on the Soweto uprisings called Soweto Black Revolt, White Reaction, which was very famous and had a lot of lessons for South Africa that should have taken to heart in 1976. But he was unfortunately only truly proven right 30 years later. He was then appointed as CEO of the Institute of Race Relations in 1983, and it was very close to being bankrupt. He needed to rebuild its finances. He did this with incredible success. At his retirement, it boasted a war chest of over 40 million rand, which has very contributed to keeping all of us employed. So I'm thankful to the work of Mr. John Kane Berman, even from just that level. He also did a lot of work, and this earned him a lot of enemies from people who used to admire him, in keeping the Institute out of the umbrella of the United Democratic Front, the ANC sort of umbrella organization. He fought very hard both at NUSAS and at the IRR to prevent the IRR either being captured by the right or left. And during the 80s, there was a very big push to align the IRR with the ANC rather than sticking true to its liberal principles. He refused to back down, and ultimately he won that battle when there was a huge amount of pressure on him to keep the IRR independent from the ANC and keep pushing for the values that it endorses still to this very day of non-racialism. He gave over 700 public speeches and wrote many reports during his time as the CEO of the IRR. Many newspaper columns, a number of books, one of the most influential being The Silent Revolution, which was published in 1989, talking about the ways that apartheid was sort of collapsing from individual actions, ordinary people. Our current CEO, John Endres, says his brave and unstinting commitment to the liberal cause inspired legions of South African liberals, myself included. John Kane Burman was known for his eloquent presentation, exceptional memory, thorough command of his subject matter, and exemplary discipline. He was demanding, setting the highest standards for himself and others because he realized the importance of the project he was engaged in, to insist that nothing less than true non-racialism and personal freedom would allow the dignity and prosperity of all South Africans to flourish. John Kane Burman's own words about himself were, "I myself never had any weapons other than words." He is survived by his longtime life partner, Pierre, and we send condolences to Pierre and his whole family. It's a very great loss for us. He was a great guy in many ways, great intellect, and the liberal movement in South Africa, I think, is much poorer for it. Sholin, anything to add very briefly before we move on to the show?
What I would say, Nick, is that I am genuinely grateful for, obviously, the work that John Kane Burman did, not just for the IRR, but for the entire liberal movement in South Africa. I think we just discussed, Nick, if JKB did not put in the work and time and effort that he did, where would the liberal tradition have been in South Africa? In some alternate reality, it's probably a very unfortunate scene for liberalism. But due to obviously his effort and so forth, and the legacy that he basically put down, it's definitely very beneficial for this country. And I think today should definitely serve as a reminder, as I'm sure you'd want it to be, serve as a reminder that our work for freedom and liberty, it's merely only just begun, and that we should take this in our stride and continue what he has laid down, for sure.
Chris?
Just to say that if those of us involved at the RR and other organizations attain even 10-20% of the work and the commitment and the principle defending that JKB did, then I think liberalism is in a very strong suit going forward, and that's probably the best way we can pay honor to him, is to continue that fight for the right reasons.
No, very definitely. And I would encourage everyone to check out the full obituary we've put on thedailyfriend.co.za, just remembering his life and contribution to South Africa and to the IRR. All right, so let's move on to our first story, and this is about the delicate coalitions that are going on across the country. So, of course, the country already has a number of very shaky coalition governments, one of them being in Johannesburg, another in Tswane, another in Ekurhuleni. There have been several attempts to create other ones, such as in eThekwini, which failed on to unseat the ANC there. And another attempt was made in Nelson Mandela Bay shortly after the election to create a coalition, which failed there and saw the ANC return to power in the city after it was under a shaky DA coalition for a while. However, today, the DA announced that it was signing a coalition agreement with several other parties to take back control of Nelson Mandela Bay from the ANC, and the city has been, the municipality has been distressed by many crises recently, including a major water shortage. So it's not a fun position to be in, to be governing that mess. But what's quite interesting is the composition of this coalition government, which is, shall we say, diverse, to put it politely. The coalition consists of the Democratic Alliance, the Freedom Front Plus, the ACDP, African Christian Democratic Party, the AIC, also known as the African Independent Congress, the Ubuntu Integrity Movement, the PAC, the Pan-Africanist Congress, and the United Democratic Movement, the UDM, who famously fell out with the DA after 2016. Due to the coalition negotiations there. I think they had the deputy mayorship, and the DA wanted to fire the UDM mayor because they said he was corrupt, and that caused the UDM to withdraw support. So I guess the question really is, is this coalition going to last, firstly? And secondly, you know, these parties, you can see maybe the Freedom Front Plus, the ACDP, the DA, and maybe to some degree the UDM kind of getting along on at least a number of issues. But at the same time, there's also quite a lot of differences between those parties. Let me start with you, Chris. What do you make of the prospects for this coalition government? Do you think it will be able to change the situation in Nelson Mandela Bay?
I suppose maybe the easiest way to answer a very difficult question, as you say, a very diverse coalition, is how much are they going to agree on the immediate priorities and reforms that they need to implement in Nelson Mandela Bay to effect tangible change for the voters. If you don't get that stuff right and the voters see more bickering, then the likelihood is that that'll increase pressure on the coalition partners, and that in turn means more infighting, that means a shorter lifespan, that means the coalition won't last that long. So can they agree on some of those things? Can they get those changes in effect? Can they change around what previous administrations have been doing or not?
So just to flesh that out, the DA says that they spent 4 months in negotiation with the various partners here, and that all parties have agreed to sign on to a document and a formal agreement with shared values, commitments, and objectives. So this is how coalition governments are done, for example, in Germany, where all the parties sign very detailed, extensive coalition agreements before they form a government together. Do you think that that's going to work here?
Well, it's all well and good having things on paper, but when you get into the dirtiness of governance and politics and you need to roll back some of what came before, are you actually going to stick to those agreements and stick to those principles? Are you going to compromise or not? How are you going to sell it to your voters? Are you going to convince people that you are trying to effect change? I mean, even now in the city of Joburg, we've had a coalition government for a while, but a lot of voters, people on the ground and civil society groups aren't saying that they're seeing the necessary changes. So that increases again the pressure on the coalition, and will they again get the necessary votes in upcoming municipal elections, sort of thing. I do think South Africans should get used to this sort of setup. Talking about places like Israel and Germany, if you think that those politics are messy, get used to that sort of thing in South Africa. This also forms part of the analysis that we would do at the CRA, for example, for clients, when we talk about getting yourself used to coalition politics, and that this is probably how South African politics is going to look going forward. It won't just be dominated by one or two players anymore, but it's about getting the power sharing right and getting the few principles and practical policy changes in place that you want to agree on, and then moving from there. I want to be hopeful for the people in Nelson Mandela Bay. I mean, been subject to all sorts of maladministration and abuses and that sort of thing for the last while. Someone who studied in the Eastern Cape, I want to see municipalities there doing better, but don't hedge your bets on everything being solved right now by this coalition. It's going to take a while to get some of these teething problems right.
Sholin, what do you make of this? You said that you had a strong feeling of optimism about the potential for this coalition.
Yeah, Nick, I have to say I am rather optimistic about this. I know in South Africa, politicians usually don't give us a reason to be hopeful or actually have, have good views of the future. But I think we are always bashing political parties and politicians, you know, for usually being selfish, for being selfish and so forth. But in this instance, I do think that we should actually be hopeful that this translates into better circumstances for the people in the region. And this will probably be a template going forward, as we've seen in Gauteng as well. This will be a template for how things are going to be run in the country after 2024. And if you are a person who wants a democratic South Africa, where power is not centralized in, you know, in a specific individual or in a political party, this is the sort of development that should actually stir some patriotism maybe inside of your bones. Because I also think that, you know, even the differences that might tear these parties apart, it's not only based on ideological differences, I think, but there's also the thing regarding positions in the municipality and the management of resources, who gets control of what. That is probably a more bigger issue that I think will be divisive amongst the political parties than necessarily ideological differences. And I also, Nick, just read that they were actually mentioning that a concern is that what about the EFF in this region? Because supposedly the political parties, even with the current coalition, will need some external support from other political parties for, I think it's for the budget votes when it comes to those things. And that is also a concern of how that will actually play out. But I think we should rather be hopeful and, yeah, hope for the best.
No, I agree with you definitely that fighting over patronage and resources is often actually, especially at the local level, far more of a concern. Also, there probably is, you know, ideological differences do definitely make difficulties because, you know, you have to decide on, for example, is BEE going to be a priority of a municipality? The ANC, and I'm sure at least some of the parties in this coalition would say yes, and some of the parties in this coalition would say no, absolutely not. So that will be something that will need to kind of be worked out. But there is more scope for cooperation at a local level when a lot of the issues are just about, you know, management, making sure that municipal entities work correctly, that kind of thing. And so, yeah, it remains to be seen whether they can make it work, whether the patronage battles tear apart this coalition. And like you say, yeah, a shaky ground, because even with this coalition, this diverse coalition, there still may be opportunities to fall it over, to collapse it from the outside anyway. But good luck to them. Chris, do you have anything to add? Cool. All right, then let us move on to our next story. And this is some sad news that a game ranger, Anton Zimba, who was the head of the sort of game ranger services at Timbavati Private Game Reserve, who had a pretty good reputation in the area and had received many international visitors, has been apparently shot and killed, presumably by poachers, although not all of the details are entirely clear yet. And he was described in the reporting on him as a wildlife warrior and even received condolences for his passing from Prince William. He was apparently shot on Tuesday from the UK. And this guy had a long career. He had joined the sort of conservation services in 1997 as an erosion field worker, and went on to become a game ranger and then a senior game ranger later. Prince William said, "I'm deeply saddened to learn of the killing of Anton Mzimba, who I spoke to in November. Committed and brave rangers like Anton are central to the conservation of Africa's fantastic wildlife. Those responsible must be swiftly brought to justice. My thoughts are with his family." Timbavati Nature Reserve themselves said, "Anton lived his beliefs, never wavered from his convictions, and above all remained a brave and honest man." And there's, of course, a deeper underlying, I think, sort of policy question here, and that is one that we don't talk about a lot on this show, but I think it's maybe worth visiting, and that is conservation, poaching. I think, you know, South Africa, everyone kind of recognizes that, particularly for South Africa's rural areas, our wildlife tourism industry is has a lot of potential and already does quite a lot of business. A lot of foreign sort of game hunters come here, as well as tourists to see our wildlife. One of our colleagues said that overseas, the main things that people seem to think about South Africa these days is crime and magnificent animals. So, you know, we've already got that great sort of reputational bedrock there from which to build. But the question is, you know, how do we pull back something like poaching? Poaching has been a very serious, I think, threat to these industries. Especially rhinos, which have an enormous amount of security in order to protect them from being attacked for their horns. Chris, what are some of the policy solutions you think that we can get at to maybe try and reduce the level of poaching in our conservation areas?
Yeah, I'm going to be a second hander and pull from the writing and analysis of Ivo Fechter, someone who I hold quite highly in writing on these issues. So I would recommend reading some of his pieces at the Daily Friend website on ecological and environmental topics, including poaching. But a possible lesson to apply is simple supply and demand. So if you try and artificially constrict supply, then you're going to increase demand, and then you're going to increase the stakes for that demand. So if you're going to ensure that, for example, through your government regulations, the stock of rhino in a given area declines, then you're going to increase the price thereof. If you're going to raise those stakes, then you're going to make sure that either local or international poachers are going to go to higher lengths to get that dwindling stock, for example. So I'd recommend at least a basic application of policing, those sorts of resources, the rule of law, that kind of thing, making sure that prosecution is done effectively. So it's not just about throwing money at it, but getting the right people and processes in place. And you can lower some of those costs. So we can't put it all in the government, of course, but you can use technology to your advantage. You can use drones, all that sort of stuff. Maybe have fewer men in the field, men and women, but then make sure that they can cover wider areas if they use the right technology. And then also just secondly, you aren't going to necessarily get rid of all of it. And that doesn't mean that you can't use the money that you get from at least investing it properly. You can't use that to increase the sort of the population of a given species. You can use it accordingly to make sure that species will continue to exist regardless. And then finally, getting the right training in place for rangers and people working in game parks and that sort of thing, making sure that also they are integrated with the communities around them. I mean, they know best how those environments look, how animals maybe migrate and function. Don't just assume, you know, you can come in and drop and play, plug and play different things that have worked in other parks or other locales. Work with the people around there to make sure that those animal populations are protected. Just so, yeah, some rough ideas.
Sherlyn, you know, the syndicates that pull off this poaching stuff are often quite sophisticated, and they're, you know, a lot of them are involved in selling, you know, sort of animal parts to countries in Asia, Vietnam and China in particular, I think. And so, you know, they're not just like a couple of local guys getting together and deciding to shoot a rhino, but I'm sure that they do rely at least a little bit on maybe local informants or guides or collaborators to sort of carry out some of these activities. Do you think that maybe, you know, improving the economic conditions in our rural areas would perhaps have a positive impact on poaching?
Yeah, no, I definitely think so, because it would mean that people are then less likely to obviously engage in criminal activity like this. I think tourism is exactly one of our best selling points as a country, and that's why we should be utilizing it to the best of our ability. But maybe it has not necessarily gone down well, especially with regards to like safety and security. Whether it's things like farm murders in rural areas or this instance taking place, we know that those are areas where safety and security is maybe not the priority of our government right now. And especially when we cannot afford that our tourism sector should be, you know, this incident should be attached to our tourism sector, because, I mean, when foreigners come and they come from, you know, wealthier European countries per se, where they know that the safety security is good, they will not be coming to South Africa, where they will be either, you know, stuck in darkness or their security will be placed at risk. That is not a good tourism selling point that, you know, would increase our economic situation. Therefore, I definitely believe that would go a long way, Nick, for sure, for improving the economic situation in our rural areas.
Yeah, no, definitely an issue that needs more attention. And I suspect if economic and law and order conditions were generally better across the country, and say, for example, our borders were better policed, because of course some of our big parks in the country where we have animals like the Kruger are trans frontier parks, so they are right on the border and spill out into places like Botswana, Zim, Mozambique, and so policing those borders would probably also help to maybe control some of the trade. But anyway, a complex issue that's going to take, I think, quite a while to fix, and a sad loss for the conservation industry. But let's go on to our last story of today, and this is one that I think amused all of us greatly, which kind of shows the changing conditions in the country politically and how fast they have been. It was not long ago that people were paying top rand in order to get a seat at the table with President Cyril Ramaphosa. There were many business people falling over themselves to be photographed with our president. He was, of course, a darling of many of the media. And he has since, shall we say, run into some publicity difficulties. namely related to the Palapala conference, but also due to the lack of reform that's that his promised reform that has emerged since he took over leadership of the ANC and the country. At a recent ANC gala dinner, according to some reporting by News 24, there was a very low turnout of fundraisers, including at the president's table, where you are, for the price of between 15,000 to a million rand, able to sit with the president. The funds would go to the ANC, so this is an ANC fundraising activity, and there were lots of empty chairs. In fact, according to ANC Treasurer Paul Mashatile, the party had struggled to get people to attend and almost cancelled this particular fundraising dinner. This was hosted by the ANC Progressive Business Forum. So in the end, they managed to pull through, but I think this really does show the difficult situation that the ANC is in and how the winds have changed, that they can't even get funders to show up to some of their events. Of course, it's not helped by the fact that the ANC is not well known for being a custodian of its own money. I believe that there are stories, I'm not sure if they're confirmed yet, that ANC staff have once again not been paid at the organization. So there's clearly some big problems going on there. Sholin, what do you make of this?
Yeah, no, I definitely think it's hilarious, Nick. It's not surprising either that the ANC literally has to go and beg private individuals or wealthy individuals to come and sit at the table with our president. That should tell you a lot about the state of your president or your political party if you need to be begging people to be sitting with your senior leadership. Because clearly everybody is no longer convinced that Mr. Ramadolis has the capabilities that he'd like us to believe that he has. We know that, you know, Ramaphosa is definitely, he prides himself on being a man of process and planning. But to us, I think it appears more that he has no action. He's incapable of taking any action. And while that's his unique selling point, it's clearly not working. And we know that the ANC is in a desperate, fortunately, I should say, the ANC is in a desperate situation where they aren't even able, you know, to manage their own finances. And we've even seen that they can't even pay their own employees, whether it's at the Thule House or in other structures within the organization. That is clear signs of an ANC falling apart. And for South Africa, that is a positive prospect that should take place, in my view at least.
Chris, what do you make of this?
We have the ANC policy conference coming up this weekend, actually started today, and I'm sure that we'll see a drastic revision and amendment to their policies which have led them down this route. I'm sure that we will see new announcements next week so that they're going to question why donors aren't paying for these seats anymore. But of course, I'm only joking. Yeah, we should just keep in mind that the ANC might just become more desperate now. So as possibly the taps get turned off, they might try and resort to more radical measures to retain power. There's still the possibility of some sort of state of disaster or emergency at some point. We have the disastrous electoral amendment bill still very much in the pipeline with the possibility of postponing elections indefinitely. So we all in civil society have to keep a serious eye on that. But yeah, very much what the ANC deserves. They have their policies and their ideology have wrought then the negative consequences for South African citizens. So now at least they're suffering some of those consequences themselves in terms of not getting funding, and long may that continue.
Indeed, sir. All right. I believe that we are very close to being out of time. So thank you very much, gentlemen, for your thoughts. Like I said, we will have a special podcast probably coming out tomorrow on the life of Mr. John Cade Berman. So have a look out for that, because he was a fascinating guy and a great fighter for freedom and liberty in South Africa. So yeah, check that out. Also, please support the Institute of Race Relations. You can do that by either going to our website, ir.org.za, clicking the Join Us button and signing up there, or you can SMS your name to 32823. It's on the banner behind me if you're watching on YouTube. And we will call you back to sign you up as a friend of the Institute. Anyway, thank you very much, guys. We hope that you all have a wonderful weekend. We'll see you next week. And yeah, I hope that everything goes well and you have a wonderful weekend. Cheers.